Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL New Hampshire Talk Radio. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today kicks off our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts. Over the next several weeks, you will hear from both Republican and Democratic candidates. In one-on-one interviews, each will have an opportunity to share their background, experience, and policy priorities. They will also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. This week, you will hear from Deglan McEachran, a Democratic candidate in the 1st Congressional District race. Later in the show, I will be joined by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. A partisan appropriations process in the House continues as it braces for a clash over environmental rules, election preparations, and the politics of deficit reduction during another batch of spending bills. If the House passes the $35.3 billion Interior and Environment Bill and $23.4 billion Financial Services Bill, it will have passed half of the 12 annual appropriations bills that fund the government for the upcoming fiscal year. But both bills are chock full of potential partisan fights bound to take place on the House floor, driven largely by what several members of Congress have characterized as poison pill policy writers. Among other things, Republicans apparently want to use the Financial Services Bill to show political commitment to deficit reduction. The bill offers to set aside money to create a fund for America's kids and grandkids, but it cannot be used until the annual deficit is eliminated. Oh, by the way, the Congressional Budget Office projects the deficit will hit $1 trillion by fiscal year 2020. The House and Senate postponed talks on a batch of fiscal year 2019 spending bills amidst a snag over funding for veterans' health care. The Veterans Choice Program faces a $1.6 billion shortfall next year, and senators want to exempt the funding for the program from discretionary spending caps to avoid cutting other programs, but the House disagrees. The slowdown dampens the hopes for swift passage of spending bills before the new fiscal year begins October 1st. A special joint House and Senate committee charged with recommending changes to the broken budget process will begin private deliberations this month in an effort to reach bipartisan consensus. The private deliberations come after holding 5 public hearings. The Joint Select Committee has until November 30th to issue its recommendations. The Trump administration's new budget update, known as the Mid-Session Review, shows federal deficits rising to $890 billion for the current fiscal year and soaring well past $1 trillion in fiscal year 2019, despite the administration's overly optimistic economic projections and its proposed spending cuts. Compared to the proposed budget that the White House released in February, the update shows higher deficits for each of the next 10 years under the president's policies. Total deficits for 2019 through 2028 are now pegged at $8 trillion, which is $926 billion higher than envisioned in Trump's own proposed budget in February. The report also presents Trump's restrictive trade policies as promising large economic benefits for the United States. But many mainstream economists consider trade restrictions and trade wars as dangerous to economic growth. After next year, the administration says annual deficits will begin to fall relative to GDP. That would be a positive, but the administration's numbers are based on economic growth projections that, as the budget update acknowledges, are notably higher than forecasts by other government and private analysts. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate, Deglan McEachran. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate, Deglan McEachran. Deglin is a New Hampshire native, works in the technology sector, and lives in Portsmouth with his wife and daughter. He received his master's from Cambridge University and his undergrad degree at California, Berkeley. Deglin also spent 10 years on the U.S. rowing team and co-founded the New Hampshire for Amazon movement, which helped push New Hampshire to compete as a potential host to Amazon's second headquarters. He also co-founded New Hampshire Business Owners, an organization that promotes small business growth. Deglin is running as a Democratic candidate to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thanks for joining the show, Deglin.
It's great to be here, Chase.
Well, we're happy to have you, and you happen to be our first of the many candidate interviews that we have going on. There are quite a few candidates running, even in the 1st Congressional District. I think I want to give you a chance, before we jump into any real heady fiscal policy, opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners, share your passions and reasons for running for Congress.
Well, thanks, Chase. I'm running to give our New Hampshire's future a voice. I want the opportunities that I had to be there for my daughter. And you could say selfishly, I want her to be able to live down the street from her dad, just like I live down the street from my dad. But to do that, we need to be thinking about the future, and we need to make some investments. You know, I want to make sure that if you get sick in this country, it doesn't mean you could go bankrupt. I want us to be teaching our kids how to code, how to build the trades, really how to dream again and not where to hide in case of an active shooter. And I want a functioning government, and we can get into that, what that means. But for me, it means a government that helps us see where we need to be focusing our collective energy and attention so we can meet some of the challenges that are going to be created by automation head on. And that's why I'm in this race. It's really to give New Hampshire's voice in the future when it comes to all of the problems that we're talking about and some of the problems we're not talking about right now.
So let's jump off on the last topic you mentioned there, and that is investing in our future, preparing for our future. It's probably not a secret to you that there are aspects of the federal government that are shifting dramatically. We have discretionary spending, mandatory spending. Discretionary spending, which is what Congress has control of on an annual basis, largely holds where we invest in terms of the federal government and the future of our nation. And that's a diminishing number. So I guess my question would be, what areas do you want to see investment grow? And if that means investing a higher number of dollars, how do you think we pay for it?
Sure. So this is the problem that we have with politicians. And I'm a little new to this politics game. So it's not as beaten into me as maybe some of the others. But education is something where I see a great return on investment. And I like to joke the old business adage, what happens if we invest in our employees and they all leave? Well, it's better than not investing in our employees and all of them staying. So when it comes to education, we're not doing near enough. And I think a lot of that has to do, a lot of it is, our federal budget doesn't really come into play when it comes to education. Here in New Hampshire, it's only 8% of the total budget. And I would like to see some strategic initiatives specifically around Title IIA money. Now, Title IIA money goes for teacher retainment, recruitment, and education. I would like to see us teach our teachers how to teach coding. That is something that I think New Hampshire, with the population that we have, could easily be a state where every kid graduates high school with the ability to code. And if we could do that, I think we'd be attracting businesses.
And so you're talking about, at least it sounds like, sort of a shift in how we think about education as a country and how we, I guess, invest in teachers moving forward.
Yeah, and that's so it's always going to be in New Hampshire. We have a tough fight when it comes to really investing in teachers in this state. And I have a fundamental belief that you do not need to go to college in order to become a computer programmer. I think that we should update our curriculum on the K-12 level so that kids are graduating with those skills that are necessary. If they want to go to college, or even if college is a K-14 initiative, that's great. But we need to say together, we want our kids graduating with the ability to get a job and go after the American dream. And being in technology, if I can make just one more point, it doesn't just mean creating a bunch of coders. It means focusing on the things where technology isn't going to displace, like the trades. And we could be investing in making sure that people are graduating with the ability to go into, become a welder, become an electrician. And electricians earn, on average, $5,400 more than a four-year college degree earner in this country. That's something that we should be promoting more, and that we should be putting money on the federal level towards states that want to incentivize that.
I think that makes sense, you know, investing in the future of our country, future generations, having an eye in education on things like you mentioned, automation, and how that's changing different industries. So my follow-up to that would be, how do you get bipartisan buy-in on some of these policies? Some might just be, you know, attrition. You know, we are sort of forced into that way of thinking. But to have a long-term mindset and get us thinking in terms of investment, how will you pull both Republicans and Democrats along to have that perspective? And then, like you said, it might require more federal dollars. Where do you pull the money from?
Yeah, so first off, I think as Democrats, we just haven't done ourselves any favors when it comes to arguing about the benefits of government. We try to get into an argument with Republicans on who can make the government smaller and in a way get out of our lives. And that's not something that, if we never talk about the benefits of government, who's ever going to vote for the benefits of government? If all somebody sees is a crumbling bridge, a failing school system, and a higher tax bill, who would want more of that kind of government? And so as Democrats, we got to stop being afraid to talk about our collective voice. And where that money comes from, you know, we have a tax cut that, although they say it's permanent, we can roll back. And that's something that I would like to see done. That tax cut went to high income earners. It went to corporations. And it hasn't flown down to working class people. In fact, the stock buybacks that everybody was predicting were going to happen ended up happening. That's something that collectively we could do a lot better on. And we would see the return on that investment if we were focusing on education. And one final point on that is I don't think Democrats win the argument of telling everybody needs to go to college. Because there's so many people that I know that didn't go to college and have been wildly successful. I think when we get away from saying the goal is to have everybody go to a four-year college and get back to the goal of everybody graduating high school, like my father did, with the ability to go after the American dream. You know, granted, he's 80 years old. We haven't done that in a long time. But getting back to investing in education so that it's affordable to go to college, and it's actually beneficial to graduate high school with a degree. I think that's a more bipartisan approach than saying everybody's got to get a history degree like Deglin.
And Deglin, you kicked the door wide open for me on tax policy when you brought up the latest tax code overhaul. And frankly, we had over a $600 billion budget deficit last year. We're on our way to an $800 billion budget deficit this year. Many economists and analysts have looked at that tax reform bill and noted that it could add an additional $1 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years. If you were in Congress at the time this thing was going through, or even if you know you're in Congress at the end of this election period, what would your model tax code look like? How would you, like you said, you can try and roll it back or make a change. What would your ideal tax code look like?
Well, a tax code, I don't think that we need a constitutional amendment to balance a budget. I don't think that's how a government works. I do think that the deficit levels that we're experiencing right now are going to start crowding out private investment. I think that is a problem that we need to talk about. But nobody talks about, or at least I don't know, maybe on your show you talk about it all the time, but the FDR deficit. That's something that we grew out of. And I think as America, we need to be focusing on investing in ways that are going to bring money back to the people that are able to spend that money and create opportunities where people can create more wealth in this country. And investments are the biggest way that we can do that. At the end of the day, we need to be able to grow as a country. We have to grow the economy, create more opportunity for more people. Any tax policy that I would take in Congress understands that, you know, CEOs do not build companies. People build companies when they buy products. People build companies when they are paid a living wage and allowed to chase down the American dream. And that's what I would bring to Congress, is the understanding that, you know, Democrats aren't sacrificing economic growth for fairness, but fairness is essential to economic growth in this country. We need more people with a seat at the table.
This is Facing the Future, and I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Deglin McEachran. We're discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on some of the nation's fiscal challenges. And Deglin, you mentioned something about growing out of budget deficits. And however, because of the growth of mandatory spending, so, and this will probably get into health care issues, which I know are a passion of yours, the growth of mandatory spending, which is programs primarily like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, They're growing at such a rate that it's faster than economic growth. It's faster than revenue generation. So there's concern, and even, you know, politicians and analysts alike are now saying we have gone past the point of just being able to grow out of the deficits we're currently in, and we'll have to start making some tougher decisions when it comes to either investment or how some of those programs are structured in the long term. So I wonder if you could speak to, when confronting this growth of mandatory spending, and it's not to say they're inherently bad programs, but would you make any reforms or changes to them to help shift gears to investing in the future of our nation as opposed to, I guess, policies that have been in place for decades?
Yeah, so great question. We'll take healthcare head on there. I do not believe our system that we have right now, you know, when we look at Medicare, Medicare gets somebody when they're 65 with no ability to control the costs. No ability if somebody needs dialysis or amputation or anything that might be associated with diabetes and diabetes care to really affect the outcome of that person once they're 65. That ship has sailed. That was when they were 25 and maybe a pre-diabetic, you know, 35, 45 when they first entered having diabetes. These are decisions that if we want to start bending the cost curve when it comes to Medicare, in this country, we need to be looking at it earlier. We need to be looking at a holistic health plan. That's why I support Medicare for All. And it comes from not only the aspect, the fact that it's a moral issue. For me, this isn't a campaign issue. My wife got sick. She got autoimmune disease. It's lupus. There are days where she feels great, and there are days where she is just super tough. And it's likely that our daughter will have that in some capacity because her mother had it and her grandmother had it. So I bristle at the fact when somebody says, oh, this is a campaign issue, because it's not. It's just a life issue that we face and a lot of Americans face. That being said, here in this country, healthcare, 18% of GDP and growing, you don't have to listen to a liberal from the seacoast to believe that we have a problem there. You can just ask Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett says healthcare is the tapeworm on this economy. Him, Jamie Dimon, who your listeners probably know as a small community banker down in New York City at JP Morgan Chase, and Jeff Bezos, who might have delivered any one of us a package in the last day. Now, yes, yesterday was Prime Day. But on the campaign
trail. Did yours come via a drone, or was it still?
No, still the USPS that takes that last mile. But all of that, they are removing their employees from the healthcare exchange because it's too expensive. And for a business, as a small business, I definitely don't understand why businesses have to be in the business of providing healthcare. As a large company, you know, after 200 employees, you're spending like a week looking at actuarial tables. You're constantly changing plans to keep costs low. And that's the biggest problem in America. We have rental car healthcare in this country. And that could be because you change jobs, as you have to do to increase your salary. It could be because you go in and out of affording coverage as a small business owner. What most likely happens is that your small business or your company is changing plans every single year to keep costs low. You likely see your deductibles raise. That is a problem because health insurance companies don't have a long-term incentive to keep us healthy. They have a long-term incentive to not pay out enormous amounts of medical bills, but you're on a coverage plan for 3 to 5 years. I don't see how they can take a long view, especially when they know Medicare is going to be picking up the tab and when you're 65, to keep you healthy in a long term. And so if we want to be talking about lowering the cost of care, if we want to be talking about bending that cost curve, actually, you know, we should probably pick and choose some of the best parts of every other industrialized nation across the globe, planet Earth. And so that's something that I think if we're honest about trying to lower that cost and lower some of the spending that we're doing on Medicare, that's something that we have to be honest about ourselves is a direction that I think our country needs to move forward because of the fact that it's going to allow small businesses to flourish if they don't have to worry about that.
And Declan, you make some great points on the need to reform our healthcare system. I certainly appreciate that it is an individual family issue for you as opposed to a campaign issue. If we go the route of universal healthcare as a country, which wouldn't only require a system shift, but almost an ideological shift in terms of how our country and its citizens view healthcare. Say we go that route, say Medicare for All is deemed the best route. If you were in Congress, what would that system look like? Because I've read some numbers, and if we switch to a program like that, you're looking at a $15 trillion cost over 10 years. There's debate over whether that's still going to be a premium-based and payroll tax-based system or purely a tax system. I mean, there's a wide gamut of ways you could approach this. So How would it look to you in your ideal world? How do you pay for it?
Yeah, so we pay for it. The costs eventually go down from an efficiency standpoint. We just go from paying when you can least afford it, when you actually are getting sick and you're paying those out-of-pocket expenses, to have it being a tax-based system. Now, Canada is a pretty good example. They have a higher tax base than us, about 3%. They don't have deductibles. They don't have premiums. That is a benefit to them. When I was doing the numbers, we were paying, you know, as a percentage of our income, you know, 8-9% per year when it came to healthcare costs. That's a huge problem in this country. But Democrats, we have to be honest about the fact that it's going to cost the federal government more if we move to that system. There's not a free lunch. But collectively, I think it is a better way for us to pay and not have to worry about getting sick in this country and be able to start being able to lower prescription drugs, for example. You know, one of the biggest things I'd like to do is repeal Medicare Part D's program where you're not, and that was passed in 2004, where you're not allowed as Medicare to negotiate with drug companies. That's not a free market. You know, that is a market failure. So we need to be able to have that conversation. But as Democrats, if we want to improve the ACA, and there's many of your listeners that say, hey, just let's improve the ACA, that doesn't happen by going down there and saying we're going to move the deck chairs. Because the Republicans on the other side of the aisle, they have a clear view that we need to remove all of this. Now, I do not believe that that's the case, but I'm not going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory if we go down there. And because I campaigned and because I won on Medicare for All, now a public option's back on the table, or now the ability for work to buy into Medicare and expand that, or to maybe lower Medicare to 55. You know, there's so many people on the campaign trail that I see that are just praying to make it to 65, that are 62, that are paying out of pocket for expenses, that need to make it to 65 for them just to be able to afford to live. So I'm not going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory there. I would work and compromise, but compromise after an election, when you come away and you're talking to the Republicans and say, hey, this is the mandate that I won here in New Hampshire to fight for this. Let's see if we can compromise to improve the lives of the American people.
And Deglan, clearly Medicare for All, universal health care coverage, is a policy priority for you in your campaign as you go down to Washington, should you win in November. Would you be willing to commit to paying for whatever plan comes out? Because I, frankly, I'm sitting across the table from you, and my biggest concern, you know, running a show on fiscal policy-oriented issues, and we've got this mountain of debt, over $21 trillion, growing budget deficits, and the primary drivers are what we have is existing healthcare programs. So my concern is, regardless of where the nation goes with the next system, you know, are you willing to be part of the push to make sure we're paying for it appropriately?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, I think that's as a Democrat, we need to be talking about investments in what we see collectively. That's what a government does. It says, hey, we could probably come together and do this better, more efficiently, if we could collectively say this is the future that we want to live in. I want a future where my child graduates from high school with the ability to code. I want a future where getting sick doesn't make you go bankrupt. And I want a future where we have a functioning government that's talking about the benefits and the trade-offs to things, and we can have a conversation. Now, we got to get through gerrymandering. We got to get through money out of politics in order to have some of those conversations. But if there's one thing your viewers can come away with, is that I am a reasonable person. I believe in these issues, and if they don't agree with me on all of these issues, I'm okay with that, as long as they know that I'm authentically coming after these issues, because I believe that this is what this country needs moving forward. And I'm going to work with each and every one of them to try to convince them of that. But if I can't convince them, I'm right. I just want to convince them that I'm talking about it authentically.
Well, one more topic before we go. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I think we can keep talking for another hour.
We haven't even talked about our former rowing careers.
I know, right? I actually wanted to bond over that with you. You certainly went farther than I did.
Wow,
but
it's just you keep showing up. That's
well,
it.
You're
that's
like 8 inches taller than I am, because no one can see what we're looking at in the studio. But my last topic here, and it's a big one, I think, on a national level and even for Democrats, is Social Security. The Social Security trustees came out with their latest report. They see the system on a downward track. It's, you know, reaching a point of insolvency by 2034. And the reason why I bring that up is because they say at that point, if we continue to do nothing, you're looking at about a 24% benefit cut across the board. So even if we have a political divide on this particular topic, there still needs to be something done about the system to either make it sustainable long-term or alter it for the next generation. So what do you think should be done with Social Security from your perspective?
In this country, and this is, we haven't talked much about income inequality, but that is one of the biggest drivers. In 1950, if you were born in 1950, you were 90% more likely.
I wasn't born in 1950.
We're the same. You were 90% likely to earn more money than your parents. Born in 1980, which I think is around our vintage, you were only 50% likely to earn more money than your parents. And a kid born in 2010 only has a 10% shot. And I really believe, for me, that's because we haven't invested in institutions. And in this country, we value capital over labor in just about everything that we do. And so when it comes to Social Security, I think we should be raising the tax cap on that to be able to actually fund that. We should be able to give them some peace of mind that they're not going to have to go hungry. And I think governments are judged on not how we choose to treat those with power, but in many ways, those that are powerless. And I think collectively, we have to look at the tax cap on Social Security and raise that.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Deglan McEachran discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thanks for joining the show, Deglan.
Hey, Chase, it was great to be here.
Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, to discuss the mid-session review of the current administration's budget. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, who is a regular on the program. Welcome back, Bob.
Hi, Chase. Good to be with you.
So today, we're going to continue sort of this theme that we've had the last couple shows with you. We're talking about reports that have been issued, and one that came out over the weekend, sort of breaking news in some respects from the administration, maybe not the topic that most might think, but the Office of Management and Budget put out what is called a mid-session review, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, what the report is and what it said in this particular instance.
Well, cynics might argue that a good time to drop a mid-session review that's going to show large budget deficits is when the president is off making other news, and that's actually what happened this weekend. The budget, and actually it usually is, the mid-session review usually is released in mid-July, not typically over a weekend, but the mid-session review is just a look at the president's budget halfway through the fiscal year to see if there are any major changes in the budget or the economic outlook. And this was an important update, because when the president's budget was originally released, it didn't incorporate, because it came out before it happened, the major budget deal that was enacted with Congress back in earlier this year that raised the discretionary spending caps for the next couple of years. So this incorporates that, and so it shows higher deficits, pretty substantially higher deficits than the administration was projecting earlier in the year. In total, they're showing $8 trillion of deficits over the next 10 years under the president's policies. But if you look at just the next couple of years, that's really the most dramatic and the most likely numbers to come true. And they're showing a $890 billion deficit for this year that we're in. That ends on September 30th, this fiscal year. So for the next fiscal year, 2019, they're projecting over a $1 trillion deficit, and that would continue over $1 trillion for the next couple of years, 2020 and 2021. And then gradually the budget shows the deficits beginning to decline, but they're higher than they were originally in every year. And they're still, in total, the president's budget is actually more optimistic than the CBO's assessment of the president's budget, which instead of $8 trillion worth of deficits over the next 10 years, estimated something like $9.5 trillion over that time period. So the bottom line is the administration is looking at pretty substantial deficits in the next couple of years, and they're assuming that a lot of hypothetical spending cuts and economic growth will turn things around sometime in the by and by, you know, more than 4 or 5 years out.
And Bob, you covered a lot of territory in those couple minutes of description. I just want to get a point of clarification across. We're talking about the president's budget proposal, right? Not some forecast by CBO, but what the administration itself is putting forth as policy agenda items.
Right. What this shows is what the president's budget office is saying would happen if all of the president's policies were enacted and based on the president's own assessment of the economy.
And even taking that into consideration, they put out their proposal, I think, what was it, February of this year, and forecasted what they anticipated might be budget deficits based on different policy items. And those deficits are growing even from that point within the administration's own projections. Do you know how much of a difference there is between that initial proposal and what they're projecting now just a few months later?
Well, it's pretty substantial, but most of it came about because of they enacted a budget deal which raised the discretionary spending caps right after the president's budget came out. But to give you an idea of it, there in when the president's budget was first put out, they were projecting a budget deficit of $833 billion for this year. They're now projecting $890 billion. And for next year, 2019, they were projecting $984 billion, and now it's up over a trillion, you know, almost $1.1 trillion. So it's, you know, the spending deal did raise the caps considerably in the short term, and that certainly is responsible for most of the increase.
And you mentioned earlier that the Congressional Budget Office has put out some assessments, I believe, of the president's budget proposal. Do they did they take a look at this year and next in terms of potential budget deficits based off of the president's proposals? And if they did, you know, is there a difference there?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The CBO tries to score the president's budget under their own economic projections. They say, well, we have our own way of looking at the economy, so if we take the president's proposals and use our own economic projections, what would you come up with? They come up with substantially higher deficits over the 10-year period, but they're different in you know, year-to-year things. They actually show lower deficits in the next couple of years than the administration is projecting, you know, below $1 trillion. And in fact, in the next couple of years, the CBO is showing lower deficits than the administration is forecasting. But they are the key is that they're not as buoyant about the administration's projections over the longer term. So they don't show the budget getting back to the lower level that the administration is projecting. They're actually showing higher deficits.
And I know we've talked in the past about how a president's budget proposal is really just a political document in many respects. So do you see the policies that the Trump administration is currently putting out there in their budget proposal as something that will actually be acted upon in Congress?
Well, probably not. I mean, based on what's happened the last few years, Congress has negotiated higher discretionary spending caps. The administration is expecting or projecting in these numbers huge cuts in domestic discretionary spending and very, very large cuts in some of the mandatory spending programs, particularly Medicaid. And Congress hasn't really shown an appetite to make those kind of cuts. So you really have to make some heroic assumptions. But perhaps more importantly, the administration's budget is based on a rosy economic scenario where even if you make these big, big spending cuts, they're still having to rely on a presumed economic boost of more than $3 trillion to get to where you know, they say they're going to get to. And that looks like a particularly rosy scenario. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, when they looked at the president's budget, didn't give it a so-called dynamic score because they just didn't think that there was enough information.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I'm speaking with the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, about the mid-session review from the Office of Management and Budget concerning the president's budget proposal. And you mentioned a phrase in there in your last answer, Bob, mandatory spending, which actually leads me to another report, this one from the Congressional Budget Office, concerning federal mandatory spending with programs that are means-tested. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that with you today as well. But before we jump into the report, can you just give a little bit of a quick description on what mandatory spending is, you know, what means testing is, and which programs might even fall under that particular category?
Federal spending is divided between so-called mandatory spending and discretionary spending. Forget about the dictionary meaning of those terms. I mean, you know, it's not like defense spending is discretionary in the sense that, well, let's not spend any money on defense this year. But it is a so-called discretionary program because Congress appropriates the funds for it on an annual basis. Mandatory spending, and of course there's really nothing mandatory about mandatory spending. Congress could abolish it if it wanted to, but it is called mandatory spending because it operates on autopilot. Congress does not appropriate the money every year. They're mostly the benefit programs, and people who qualify for a benefit get it. So Social Security is the most biggest example of that. Medicare is another one. So, and Medicaid. And Medicaid is a good segue because the difference in mandatory spending, there's a category between programs that are so-called means-tested and programs that are not. Means-testing simply means that there's some sort of needs-based connection to the benefit. And Medicaid, as opposed to Medicare, is a means-tested program. There are some portions of Medicare that have some means-testing element to it, but Medicaid is 100% a means-tested program.
And so what did this CBO report have to say about means-tested programs? Was it an assessment of sort of where they're heading or looking at this small piece of a larger pie? What was CBO's take?
Well, they periodically do this just to give an assessment and a reminder, I guess, of the difference between these categories and how they are projected to grow in the future. And what the CBO said was that the so-called means-tested programs comprise about a quarter of total mandatory spending, and it's less than 20% of the total federal budget. And now the means-tested programs, you know, I mentioned Medicaid, that's the biggest one. It also includes the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, sometimes called SNAP, family assistance, which is sometimes known as TANF. It used to just be called welfare. There's the Supplemental Security Income Program. And those are all means tested. They're based on some sort of need. And I think looking at it as from a budgetary matter, you can see that they're not an insignificant part of the budget, but not as anywhere near as large as the non-means-tested programs. But really more significantly is that they are not growing as fast. The CBO has projected that the non-means-tested programs will grow by about 4% a year, and the means-tested programs grow by almost 6% a year. Projections over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And really the reason why is something that we get back to a lot around here, which is that the aging of the population and rising health care costs make the non-means-tested programs grow faster than the economy, whereas the means-tested programs, they do grow somewhat. Those that are health care related, you know, have that dynamic. They're going to be a little bit more expensive because providing health care is more expensive. But there isn't any thing that makes, say, the supplemental nutritional program grow faster than the economy or the family assistance program grow faster than the economy. So as the economy grows, those are not projected to keep pace, while the other programs are expected to grow faster than the economy.
And Bob, you mentioned way back when we sort of glossed over the fact that means-tested mandatory programs were about a quarter of mandatory spending, if I heard that correctly. And just to go back a step further, mandatory spending programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security are around 60% of the total federal budget at the moment. So I want to break it down even one more layer and ask, how much of that quarter of mandatory spending that is means tested is driven by Medicaid? So we mentioned all these other supplemental and support programs and safety net programs. How much of that piece of the pie is really just Medicaid as opposed to everything else?
Chase, that's a good question, because the Medicaid program at almost $400 billion is a little bit over 50% of the means-tested mandatory spending. So it's obviously it's a big chunk of it. And you can compare that to some of the other programs. Like I mentioned, the supplemental nutrition program is $69 billion projected for this year. And the family support and foster care programs, only $32 billion. So, you know, a lot of things that people think of, quote-unquote, as welfare take up a pretty small part of the budget, and it's not a part that's growing faster than the economy. And if you look at the scale of things, you know, $32 billion or $60 billion, you know, versus $400 billion in the Medicaid program is obviously a big part of the means-tested program. But, you know, Social Security is almost $1 trillion, and Medicare is approaching $1 trillion. itself. So, you know, you got to look at the scale of things here.
Yeah, and I don't want to diminish perhaps the fact that we're talking about billions of dollars and trillions of dollars. So there's certainly, you know, it's a large use of taxpayer dollars for sure. But when, like you said, when you look at the grand scheme of things, the big picture of the budget, and you compare the fact that we spend about $4 trillion a year, and we're talking about some of these small programs that are in, you know, the $50 to $60 billion range or less, you're right, those are a pretty small target, but they become a very contentious issue when you're talking about reform. So my next question for you, and it may have to be our last because I think we're running out of time, is when you look at this report and you look at the figures it puts out and it compares means-tested programs to non-means-tested mandatory programs like Social Security, what's the message you would take away from that? And you know, what if you were a member of Congress or in whispering in the ear of a member of Congress, would you suggest reform in any particular area as opposed to others?
Well, I would suggest that we do need to look at all programs. And as you pointed out, the fact that something is only $32 billion doesn't mean you ignore it, because $32 billion is a lot of money. So I wouldn't say that you can you know, just take the smaller means-tested programs and ignore them. But you can't cure trillion-dollar deficits, which are projected to get higher and higher, by focusing your attention or limiting your attention to the means-tested programs. It's just, A, it's not where the money is, and B, it's not where the projected growth is.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, discuss the OMB mid-session report, as well as CBO's report on federal mandatory spending for means-tested programs. Thank you for joining the show again, Bob.
You're welcome.
Next week, I'll be joined on the show by two more congressional candidates, Maura Sullivan and Terrence O'Rourke. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.